Welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper recovering from a serious back injury, but he is doing much better, I am glad to tell you. So today we look back at a slice of long-lost Florida history, Henry Flagler's Long Key Fishing Camp. Joining us is author Thomas Neal Knowles, a fourth-generation Kunk. He was born and raised in Key West, where his ancestors had arrived in the mid-1850s from the Bahamas. His latest book is Long Key, Flagler's Island Getaway for the Rich and Famous, and he joins us via Skype from his home in Tallahassee. Welcome, Thomas Neal Knowles.
Hello, Bonnie.
Hi, great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So I was going to begin with some things about Henry Flagler, but before we get to him, tell us more about you and your background, your ancestors, your interest in the history of the Keys.
Well, my interest in the Keys and of course, stems from being there so much. And in the early 1990s, I started doing genealogy research on the family and learned that two of my ancestors, or two of my relatives, rather, had died in the 1935 Labor Day hurricane. So I began to look up information on the storm and was unable to find a very comprehensive and well-documented book about it. So I started collecting information, family and friends, and gathered quite a bit, finally enough that I thought, well, this would make a good book itself. So from there, I got into writing business, you might say. I entered rather lately. I started publishing some articles when I was 64, and then my first book came out when I was 69.
Mm-hmm.
The first book was about the hurricane. It's entitled Category 5, the 1935 Labor Day Hurricane. And that's when I learned about the Long Key Fishing Camp. Prior to that, I had not heard much about it, even being born and raised in Key West. And it's one of those subjects that seems to have slipped through the cracks of history.
Yeah, it really is a very interesting. You have some great photographs in the book too, and maps and stuff. I will say that really interesting photographs. Well, it's interesting that Henry Flagler's hotel empire began so simply, as you put it, because he couldn't find adequate accommodations in St. Augustine for people of means. So, in fact, Henry Flagler, you write in 1885, at the age of 55, left his active role with Standard Oil and began his hotel and railroad empire in Florida. Why did he do that? Do we know why?
Well, he was truly an amazing man. First of all, he was with Standard Oil as a partner with John Rockefeller for about 17 years, and he had already lost one fortune, and he made his second fortune with Standard Oil, so he had lots of money. His wife was ill with a lung illness, and they went to St. Augustine in about 1876 to see if the climate would help her. The accommodations in St. Augustine at that time were so terrible that they left soon after they arrived and stayed in Jacksonville for about 2 weeks and then went back north. But in 1885, apparently during that trip, the first trip, he had seen some potential there at St. Augustine. So in 1885, after his wife had died and he'd remarried, he took his new bride and went to St. Augustine and had a much more enjoyable stay. But the hotel he was at didn't have anything for people to do except take walks. And that's when he decided he was going to get into the hotel business. One of his biographers said that he always wanted to become an innkeeper, but now he did it on a grand scale.
An innkeeper, that's a little modest way of putting it, isn't it?
Well, it is, but you have to remember that Henry started life being in a family that was flat broke, mm-hmm. I mean, poor. And so his aspirations as he was growing up were scaled down. But after he made his fortune with Standard Oil, he just decided to go ahead and do it right and get into the business.
Well, before we get to the Long Key and the fishing camp there, that was the last resort to open in his lifetime. Would you give us a little history on the other eight more extravagant and opulent hotels that he opened? The first one was in St. Augustine, is that right?
That's right. It was the Ponce de Leon, and that was probably his most lavish and palatial hotel that he built. And it had fine marble imported from Africa in it, huge oak columns in the lobby, a large ballroom and dining room that had orchestra stations at either end so that two orchestras could play. It was that large. It could accommodate about 800 people. And it looked like a Spanish castle from the outside. And then he also built the, or renovated, I should say, the Alcazar next door. So, and that was intended for people with less means, but still it was on the upscale. Then he went down to Ormond Beach and he acquired the Ormond, a hotel that was there already, but had it extensively renovated. And then he went to back to St. Augustine again and built the Cordova. Then he went down in 1894 to West Palm Beach, built the Royal Ponciana, which at the time was the largest wood frame building ever built. Mm. And it had a capacity of holding over 1,200 guests, or 1,200 guest rooms, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Which was huge for the time, I would think.
It was monstrous. Now, then he went to across the bay to Palm Beach and built the Breakers.
Mm-hmm.
Next, in 1897, he came down to Fort Dallas, or the Fort Dallas area. It wasn't known as Miami then. And negotiated with Julia Tuttle and was able to build the Royal Palm Hotel there, another magnificent structure that had 400 guest rooms. He had to do a little negotiation with Julia Tuttle because she was not in favor of selling alcohol in at the hotel. And that was one of Henry Flagler's key points, was that he felt all of his hotels should be able to have a bar.
Mm-hmm.
So they worked it out anyway, and the hotel was built. Then he went back up to north of St. Augustine to Atlantic Beach, just east of Jacksonville, and built the Continental. And then he went to Long Key.
Then he went to Long Key. So it's pretty amazing, I mean, that he had these eight hotels that were all these palatial, as you say, extravagant, opulent hotels. And then here is Long Key. It's this rustic. First of all, where is Long Key? Where was Long Key Fishing Camp located?
Well, Long Key is about in the middle of the Florida Keys. And if you're familiar with the layout of the Keys, they begin an arc down from Miami, almost going due south, and then curve over towards the west and go to Key West. And right where the major turn, you might say in the middle where the elbow is, just below that is Long Key. And then at the west end of Long Key is where they built the fishing camp. Actually, what they did was build a work camp there, first of all.
Right. Tell us about that, why it was a work camp before it became this fishing camp.
Well, Flagler should go back and say that one of his key keys to his mode of operation was having destinations that the wealthy could go to. And to do that, he not only had to have a hotel or some resort, he had to have a means of getting them there. So he built his railroad, and as he would go down the Florida East Coast, he would extend his railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, he got to Miami and then went to Homestead. But his overall goal was to go to Key West. And Key West was important because it could provide a deep draft harbor that was close to the Panama Canal, which was being worked on at the time and just about finished. And they could get perishable fruits and other items to Key West, and then it could be transshipped by railroad on up north much faster than trying to leave it on ships and take it up there themselves. Mm-hmm. So Key West was desirable in that respect and became an object for the railroad. He went ahead and let me just say this, by 1909, he had spent $18 million in railroads and the development of towns on the mainland. He had spent $10 million building the railroad just from Homestead to Key West, and $12 million in the hotels, the resorts. Mm-hmm. He also had another million invested in steamship lines because he had a couple of resorts over in the Bahamas. So by 1909, he had an investment of $41 million in Florida. But the work camp at Long Key was necessary because there was a large water gap between Long Key and the next key to the west, next island or significant island, Grassy Key. And a long viaduct had to be constructed across that opening. It had to be a viaduct, which is a concrete arch type structure, much like the Roman viaducts, mm-hmm. except where the water used to flow on the Romans' version, why that was the roadbed for the railroad. And it took a lot of people to do that. So they set up this work camp at the west end of Long Key with a library, a hospital, some cottages for engineers and upper staff. And then they also had quarter boats that the guys actually building the viaduct lived on. These were large buildings built on barges that could be towed from spot to pot, spot to pot to where the work was done. So Long Key had a marina, which with a ways in it that could pull up the construction boats and crafts and service them, and a large work camp. But there is evidence that Flagler was thinking ahead at that point, because he bought way more land at the west end of Long Key that he needed for the work camp.
So he was thinking ahead already to putting this sporting fishing camp there.
Yes. And
well, let's get to the camp, because, you know, it there's so much to talk about in the camp itself and how it was kind of a getaway for nobility and politicians and poets and businessmen, and yet it had nothing. It had none of the accommodations of the other. So give us a little thumbnail of what was there and the situation with the water and the bathtubs and all that.
Well, bathtubs are a very interesting situation. But first of all, most of the buildings at the camp were repurposed, as they say, after the construction of the viaduct was finished, into guest cottages or other buildings such as a post office and general store and things like that. And those were wood frame buildings without much ornamentation on them, in fact, none at all when they were work camp buildings. And some of them were large bunkhouses that were converted. One was converted into a dining hall, and several others were converted into multiple guest room buildings. And eventually after that, converted into large homes for several wealthy guests or families. The only building that was built brand new, so to speak, expressly for the resort was the lodge, a two-story structure that had the front desk or check-in place down on the first floor and a large lounge. It also had two bathtubs in it in another room, and I'll get back to those in a minute. And upstairs it had a sitting room and a library and so forth. But it was intended as a room where people could socialize when the weather was too bad for fishing and or other outdoor activities. Now, the camp was only open to guests for about 4 months out of the year. And this was true of most of Flagler's hotels, even the large posh ones up on the mainland. They would be open from about the end of December through the middle of April. And at Long Key, that was a time when the least amount of rain fell and there was no natural water supply on the island. That is, you couldn't drill a well. So they had to bring all fresh water for the resort down on the trains, big cypress tanks on flat cars, and they'd fill them up at a well field just south of Homestead. Mm-hmm. So fresh water was a very precious commodity at the camp. As a matter of fact, all of the primary water used there for washing, general washing and flushing the sewer system and fire prevention and so forth was salt water. They would pump that up into a tank. And each of the cottages had a shower in them, but they were salt water showers. And so the fresh water being such a precious commodity, they did have two bathtubs, one for men and one for women, at this resort for the wealthy. And you had to make reservations to use those. And presumably you could get hot water in there as well, because the hotel was open during the coolest months of the year there, and sometimes it could get quite chilly. As a matter of fact, the lodge had a fireplace.
And there was also limited access to any communication with the outside world. So it's amazing that it fostered this fierce loyalty among its clients, who were, as you said, a virtual who's who of the rich and famous. What were they so attracted to come to this, where they couldn't take a bath, they had to take a salt water shower and then a fresh water rinse and no communications? Was it the serenity? Was it the fish?
Well, I think it was all of that. There was also the bay side of the camp, that is Florida Bay, to the north of the camp, was relatively sheltered water and could be traversed by canoes or small boats and into the keys there, and where all sorts of wildlife was nesting and breeding. They could also, on the south side, go out into the Atlantic or out to the Living Reef and fish along there. So it had an appeal to people who loved the outdoors, wildlife people, as well as just fishermen. And there were large game fish, of course, out in the Gulf Stream. So it had wide appeal. Plus, it was very quiet there for the most part. The train did come through twice a day, once in the morning and once at night.
And, well, let's look at some of the people that came there, because, as you say, it is this list of just such luminaries, beginning with Zane Grey, the very popular writer, and then he started this Long Key Fishing Club.
Right. Zane Grey first arrived at Long Key by accident. He had just had his first bestseller. This was about 1912 or so, and he and his brother were going down to Mexico to do some fishing. But on the way, the liner received word that there was an outbreak of a disease down at the place they were going to, and so they got off the ship in Nassau and just happened, as Gray put it, to land at Long Key. And he went out fishing there, and after that, he was so hooked, he kept coming back year after year.
How did all these people find out about it? I mean, they didn't, was it just one would tell another? Was it just word of mouth?
Well, some of it was, and some of it was due to the fact that L.P. Scott was the manager of the Long Key, first manager of the Long Key Fishing Camp. And a lot of the wealthy had known him from where he operated resorts up in the Catskill Mountains during the fall and winter. And so he drew some people in, but the main bulk of people who came to Long Key were drawn there by accounts in the media and newspapers about Zane Grey's activities in fishing there, and by Zane Grey's articles and books that he had written, because he did write about Long Key and the fishing.
Right. Well, let's just name some of these people, because, I mean, Lou Gehrig, the Yankee slugger, and millionaires Andrew Mellon and William Randolph Hearst, and even two presidents, President FDR and Herbert Hoover, were there. And this was all for relaxation, getting away, and fishing?
Well, Wallace Stevens didn't really like to fish that much, but he went there, first of all, with business associates. He was with the Hartford Insurance Company, which is, as you know, was based at that time in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the claims department, and his area of the nation that he dealt with was the Southeast. So he, anyway, arranged his schedule so that after his first visit to Long Key, so that he would always be able to go down during the winter months and get out of the cold in the north and spend a while at Long Key. He really enjoyed it there because of the quiet, the palm trees. The work camp and the Long Key Resort was built in what had previously been a large coconut plantation. And so there were many palm trees and this long, white, sandy beach, and these rustic cabins. And also, while he was down there a couple times, there were no women about, and he felt free to go swimming. He wrote this in a letter to his wife. He said he went swimming in his nightgown.
Well, there were some women and families, you say. I mean, I guess it seems like mostly there were men, but you say families came and also women were there.
Yes, and in fact, one of the more interesting guests was the Countess of Suffolk and Berkshire, who was a Chicagoan who had married into British nobility. And she had her own house constructed down at Long Key about 1930, a huge structure. And they also had Benjamin Crowninshield, I should say, Thomas was his grandfather, had another of these large bunkhouses converted into a house for him. And these were exclusively reserved for their use throughout the entire season. So, it cost them a bit. Also, the Cardeza family of Philadelphia had another one.
You know, Thomas, we are running out of time, so I just want to get to what happened to the camp. It was, it survived the Great Depression, and it survived for, I guess it was 25 years, and then comes the hurricane of 1935 that you wrote about. So what happened when the hurricane hit the Long Key fishing camp?
Well, it was the first hurricane to be documented as a Category 5 that struck the U.S. mainland. And so it was a very powerful storm. And even though Long Key, the center did not pass directly over it, it did pass close enough that it just did horrific damage. The entire camp was destroyed, literally left in splinters. But James Duane, otherwise known as Buck Duane, was the caretaker at the camp, and this was during the off season now, so there weren't any guests there, got the 20 people that were on Long Key together and took them to a structure, and in fact the Countess's house, and that's probably what saved their lives.
So all 20 of them lived.
Unfortunately, he never received recognition for his heroic acts, but he certainly deserved. Not a one was lost, and they escaped with minor injuries.
Well, you've given him some recognition now. So before we go, Thomas, what's the state of Long Key today?
Well, most the land that Flagler owned is now all developed, but the rest of the island is basically a state park, except for the city of Layton, which is about in the middle. It's a small settlement. I think it had 140 people or so when the 2006 census was taken. Anyway, it's basically been preserved much like it was at the time the camp was there.
Well, and that's good that they have it now preserved. We've been speaking with Thomas Neal Knowles. He was a naval officer and 32 years an administrator at Florida State University. And his first book, Category 5, the 1935 Labor Day Hurricane, looks back at that first documented Category 5 storm to make landfall. And this book that we've been discussing, which is rich in information, is Long Key, Florida's Island Getaway for the Rich and Famous. So, Thomas Neal Knowles, it's been a pleasure having you with us today. We thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Okay, and best of luck with the book and with your writing career.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Food and Dining is next. And welcome back to Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joining us now is Cordon Bleu chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend Linda Gassenheimer. So, Linda, hello.
Hello, Bonnie.
What's on the menu today?
Oh, what's on the menu? Well, Bonnie, we're partway through the summer, and maybe some people are looking for what to do with the kids.
But, you know, I don't remember cooking at summer camp, and I used to go to camp. Did you?
First, you have to ask me if I went to camp.
Did you go to camp, Linda?
It wasn't my thing.
Oh, okay.
Well, how about cooking camp, all right?
Okay.
The Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science has several programs. So it's a double whammy here. They're getting healthy cooking and they're learning about science. They have several programs there. And our guest is Carlisa Callwood. She's the Director of Programs and Content at the museum. And she's going to tell us what's happening there. And she's also going to give us a little peek, a beforehand look at what's going to happen with the new museum site at Bicentennial Park.
That's exciting.
Under construction right now. So let's welcome Carlisa Callwood.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We want to hear all about this news. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions or comments about the Science Museum? Give us a call, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Yes, yes.
I was going to say, and email.
Is radio@WLRN.org.
Okay, and also, of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column in today's Miami Herald. And by the way, the Miami Herald has they're revamping the whole food sections, and there's going to be more than one. There's going to be more food on Saturday, and there's, of course, food today.
Is that Evan Benz doing?
Yes, it certainly is. And Kendall Hammersley, who's features editor. Uh-huh. Well, you can also read Fred Tasker's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I went to Methodist Church camp, and we didn't do a lot of wine there, so I guess I have to talk about something else. Better talk about what the trends are in wine today.
All right. We'll be interested in hearing about it.
They didn't have wine at my camp either, I don't think, Fred.
Not even sacramental.
No.
Carlisa Callwood, kids, science, cooking camp. What a combination. So you mentioned the focus at the camp is going to be on science and healthy eating. So how does this work?
Yes, yeah, so this summer we're having a camp class that's called Chromatic Cooking, which looks at how we use different plants and vegetables to make healthy meals. So the class focuses on colorful plants and cooking, as well as exploring the pigments in the foods.
So let me ask you then, because they're using foods that have a lot of color.
Yes.
And they're finding out why the color helps us healthfully?
Right. So they're learning why the color is there and how those pigments can aid us in our life and for health benefits. And
wow.
also how they're used
yeah.
in different foods to help create different food types. And they'll also look at how those pigments in the food respond to things like heat and pH when you actually start the process of cooking meals.
Did they even know what pH was when they came to the camps?
Some of them probably did. We have some very sophisticated campers in our science camp.
What are the ages of the campers?
The ages for this week, the class started this week, are second and third grade. And then next week, the class will be for fourth and fifth graders.
So is there room in the class next week?
Yes, there is still space in the class for next week for fourth and fifth grade
so
students.
How fascinating. I never thought of looking at the color. Well, we already know that blueberries and apricots and those colors, they're good for us, but never thought of looking at it to why and what happens.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that's the fascinating part about it, learning all of that intricate science that goes on behind it, and that just naturally exists in the plants, and how we can use that to our advantage.
So then the children come in and they, are they cooking or are they watching a demonstration?
A little bit of both. We have Chef Kat Duran who's leading the class. So she usually does some demonstrating for them, but usually prepares some activities that the kids can do some cooking as well.
Well, fascinating. I need to go sit there and find out what all this...
When you asked if there was room in the camp, I would guess, I thought that's what you were asking, if there was room for you.
Yeah, since I hadn't been to camp, maybe I should go to this one, you think. Okay. Well, what are some of the recipes they're making?
Some of the things that they're learning to make include sweet potato hummus, beet pasta with ricotta, edible plant cells... Sweet no sour
edible plant cells. Yes, stop there. What's that?
Well, yes,
they're probably learning about the parts of plant cells and making an edible version using Jell-O and other types of foods.
Sorry, I'm confused. I don't know that any of us are going to get this straight now.
We may not. We may have to
They're looking at the plant cells through a microscope, and then they're trying to reproduce it with a kind of food.
Correct.
So
making a model of it.
If it looks like a protozoa, then they're going to make Jell-O protozoa.
Correct.
Kind of thing?
Yes.
All right. I got that part now.
Well, good for you, Linda.
Yeah, well, it took a little while. But so what is the response to the, do they like the foods, these healthy foods? Or they say, oh, healthy, I don't like it?
No, the kids really love these cooking classes. I think because they're so hands-on and they're getting to learn a lot more about it. It's one of those classes when you walk in, the kids are so engrossed. They don't want to stop for a break. Usually we have breaks where they can go play in the museum. They don't want that break time. Mm. They want to continue working in the class.
That's great, too, because then they learn how to eat healthy foods from such a young age. I mean, second and third grade, that's great.
Exactly.
Yeah, can you imagine? I can. How many are in the class?
The class caps at 25. I believe this week there are about 15 students in the class.
Well, my hat's off to a chef who works with 25 second graders cooking. That must be a challenge. Okay. So you have a Heart Smart program or something throughout the year at the Science Museum. Tell me about that.
Yes, one of our permanent exhibits at the museum is called Heart Smart, and this exhibit focuses on heart health. So what do you need to do to keep healthy and be a heart health person? And at this exhibit, what people can do is it's computer-based. They stop at the first computer, get a little ticket, and with that ticket, they can go around to various other stations, which include blood pressure machine, something that calculates their BMI from their height and weight, a system that has them input information about their daily habits. How much TV do they watch? How much exercise do they get daily?
They need to be honest about this, right?
Correct, yes. It works based on honesty. But through visiting these different components within the exhibit, they learn about what it takes to be heart health, as well as learning additional strategies that they can take with them when they leave the museum.
And this includes also food that they're...
Correct.
And this is open to the public. Anybody who goes into the museum throughout the year can do that. It's kind of a nice thing to do with some kids on a weekend day or something, see how it's going.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some of the parents
That's
need
great
it.
Education. For, I was going to say the parent, the kids can teach their parents.
Exactly.
You know?
Yes.
Right. And then you have a festival, an eating festival once a year?
Yes. Yearly, we have a Miami Eats Festival that we have typically done in April. And the Miami Eats Festival focuses on looking at the different ways that you can eat healthy here in Miami. So we typically invite various chefs and organizations that focus on healthy eating to come participate. And it's just a day of healthy eating, nutrition, fitness. When we did it this year, we had a Zumba teacher come out to talk about how you can use Zumba as a fitness technique. We highlighted our Heart Smart area that we just spoke about, but the entire day is all about how you include and make healthy eating and fitness part of your regular lives.
Oh, that's terrific. And again, open to the public
yes.
to come in. And what is the entrance for the museum?
The entrance for the museum is typically about $10 mm-hmm. for adults, nine
for
adults. Kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and also you mentioned something called Groove. What is that all about at the museum?
Yes, Groove is one of the youth programs that we're currently doing. It's a research-based program that introduces girls specifically to nutritional health concepts, benefits of increased physical activity, and teaches them to empower themselves to make their own healthy choices about food.
And why girl? Why is it focused more on girls?
The museum has had a long history on focusing on underrepresented populations in science, so specifically girls or other underserved populations. So this particular program uses the Groove Girls to focus on the science behind health, nutrition, and fitness. And because it is a research study, they're looking at how the use of technology can aid in helping them to learn about this info a little bit better.
Well, that's fascinating. Yeah. That's very, very interesting. And then you mentioned hydroponics. They're learning about hydroponics there.
Yes. The museum has started within the past year or two a hydroponics program where we're trying out the different science behind learning how to grow plants without soil in areas like Miami where you may not have as much outdoor retail space. We want to find different ways to encourage people to grow their own plants and veggies as another source.
So they can do this at home?
Yeah, they can do it at home. The museum has prototyped several different versions, a larger version that goes against the side of the wall. But there are also smaller versions that are really economical and easy to use. And we've even done them in various classes and schools where we've taught the teachers and the kids how to use these systems.
So, I mean, that's amazing because you can put nutrients in the water.
Correct.
And they can grow their plants and then have a healthy, something healthy to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Just growing in their own home.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Without a garden.
Without a garden. So even if you live in an apartment
right,
building.
Right, right.
Okay.
Great idea.
Fantastic.
We just have a quick question. Dark colors and fruit by Mary are talked about a lot as being good for you. What about things like the red, black pigment in black rice? Anybody know?
Well, I don't know.
Me either.
Okay. Well, Mary,
well,
we don't
maybe
know.
Maybe
you, somebody else does.
Somebody will come in and why not Google it and find out? But at the moment, we have to take a short break. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking with Carlisa Callwood. She's from the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Carlisa Callwood. She's the Director of Programs and Content at the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science here in Miami. She's been telling us about this summer kids' cooking camp, which sounds really, really interesting. It features science and healthy foods at the museum. And she's going to give us an inside look pretty soon at the new museum that's going up at Bicentennial Park. But meanwhile, it's dinner in minutes time. So here's a simple 10-minute meal. It's not going to heat up your kitchen. It's shrimp gazpacho with cheese toasts. So you have the sweet shrimp, easily bought, cucumbers, tomatoes. They make a cool, it's a soup supper. So how do you make it? You buy some low-salt tomato juice, some fresh tomatoes, some cucumber cubes. You put all that into a large soup bowl. And then I add a little bit of olive oil, some balsamic vinegar, and a little plain yogurt, and you stir that all together. So that's the basis for the soup.
You don't put it in the blender?
Nope, you don't. You just have the tomato soup, and then the tomatoes are cut into cubes, and the cucumber into cubes. You put that on the soup bowl, and then you add some cooked shrimp. You can buy the shrimp already cooked. Add that in, and it's as easy as that. It's a delicious, easy gazpacho. And to go with it, we have some cheese toasts. I used Manchego cheese, but you can use any kind of hard cheese. You toast some whole grain bread in either a toaster oven or under the broiler. You remove it, you add some sliced cheese to it, and toast it again till the cheese melts. That's 10 minutes. Couldn't be easier on a nice, hot, warm, hot summer day evening. The complete recipe, it's on my website, dinnerinminutes.com, and it has a photograph. Now you can find another quick and easy dinner in minutes in today's Miami Herald. It's grilled turkey sausage with mango relish and some quick coleslaw, something to do with this mega, mega mangoes crop we have this year. And please do follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
You know, first, that gazpacho sounds absolutely wonderful. I'll have to try that.
Okay.
I was thinking the same thing, friend.
Good.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyway,
well, you
I'm
know
an old
where
newspaper
you can find
guy,
it.
And we old newspaper guys love trends because spotting trends makes us look smart. So here's what's trending in wine these days. I'll put the first one in a question, Linda. Tell me, how many wineries would you say there are in the United States today?
Okay, so this is testing Linda's wine knowledge.
That's right.
Well, I would say that there are a lot. And I'd say it's probably in the thousands. Am I close?
You're close. It's 7,762.
Wow.
Which is a lot of wineries. In fact,
sure
wine is.
Is
made in all 50 states these days. Even Alaska, you say? Well, sort of.
Yes.
I checked, and the Alaska Wilderness Winery outside Kodiak makes blueberry wine, salmonberry wine, and sparkling strawberry rhubarb wine. And I can't wait to try that one.
Wait. What's salmonberry? Like salmon?
Oh, it's a lot like a Finnish lingonberry or something like that. It grows in very cold climates.
Oh, it's an actual berry. It's not a salmon fish.
No, it's not made out of salmon.
That's what I was thinking.
That would be going a little too far.
Yeah.
We were wondering, Fred.
Anyway, next, Linda. What's the average price of a bottle of wine in the U.S. these days?
I don't know. It's about $30. What do you think?
Let me guess.
$10?
$10.99.
Okay.
The latter guess is a lot closer. It's $9.19.
There you go, Bonnie. Okay. Well, Bonnie's a major.
Well, Linda buys the more expensive wine.
That's
you know,
it.
She's rich and all that.
Thank you,
that seems low, but it's actually more than three times the world average price of $3, which means that a lot of foreign people are drinking some pretty cheap wine. America, of course, is the world's biggest consumer of wine, drinking 760 million gallons last year. And in 2010, we surpassed France after they started drinking Coca-Cola and beer and starting to cut back on their wine.
Well, we're both sitting here with our mouths open.
But anyway, that's overall wine consumption. Per capita, we're only number 62 at 3 gallons per year. Okay, Linda, last question. What country is number one in wine drinking per capita? If you guess this, I'll be really impressed.
Uh-oh. Now I have to impress Fred Tasker. What am I going to do? I'm going to say maybe it might be China.
Bonnie, what would you say?
Argentina.
It is Vatican City.
Oh!
It's the world's smallest country with 100 acres and 798 very happy residents. And it makes you wonder how many tons of wafers went with that wine.
Exactly.
Well, we've got
Sacramento
some happy
wine.
People there.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so. The last question, who drinks wine in America? 55% are women, leaving men 10 percentage points behind. And one-third of America's 330 million people drink wine. Our favorite wines are, and this is in order, Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Grigio, Merlot, and blended wines. And quickly falling out of favor are White Zinfandel, for which I say hooray, and oddly enough, Syrah. And I was shocked about that. I love Syrah. I've got to look into that.
Okay.
66% of the wine we drink comes from the United States, leaving 34% as imports. And our favorite countries to import wine from are Italy, Australia, Argentina, Chile, and France. In fact, Americans drink more Italian wine than the Italians do, although that may be partly because there are about 5 Americans for every Italian.
I was going to say, some of that has to be have to do with the size.
Yeah, America's overall wine consumption has increased 2 or 3% a year for the past 21 years in a row. But now craft beer is growing faster. They were up 18% last year. So my fellow wine drinkers, those beer guzzlers are gaining on us, and we've got to try harder.
Unite.
Well, the Vatican City was
Vatican
really
Vatican City what, was definitely that, the answer of the
year. I mean, that is amazing. That very amazing. Okay, so now back to Carlisa Colwood. We see the Science Museum construction, those of us who drive by it, on Bicentennial Park, and it's making some progress. So when is it due for completion?
In 2016.
So, okay, so coming along.
Yes.
We see it's huge. I mean,
yes, it's much larger than our current space, so I think many people will be surprised once it is completed.
I had the chance to go through a hard hat tour of the new site, and it's just mind-boggling. I mean, fabulous ideas, very, very new. They're ready for anything virtual now or in the future.
Yes.
It's amazing. So tell me something. You have large areas for children. What's going on there? What will go on there?
Well, the museum will have lots of state-of-the-art new areas, one in particular, the Living Core, which will feature 600,000-gallon aquarium space.
And when I saw this spot there, it's mm-hmm. just enormous.
Yes.
600,000 gallons of water?
Yes, yes.
How are they going to contain that?
I don't know. They have figured it out. So everyone's looking forward to when that particular piece is completed because it will be phenomenal.
And what is it going to show?
It will look at the special habitats that we have here in South Florida, such as the Everglades, coral reefs, mm-hmm. hardwood hammock areas, mangroves, etc. And, you know, it will have 3 different levels, an outdoor upper level. The second level will focus on coast and offshore areas, and the lower level will be more of an immersive space where you can actually look up into the tank itself.
Oh, my goodness. And I understand that this area is going to be very, very big, so if people want to, you're going to rent it out, space out for parties and things?
Yes, exactly. It will be able for rental, and once it is completed, it'll be quite a beautiful space.
Wow. Amazing. Mm-hmm. So what else is going to go on there? Because that's just a small part of the museum.
Yes. Yes. We'll also have an innovation center that will look at new ways to use technology and science. We'll also have From the Feathers to the Stars, which will look at the evolution of flight from the dinosaurs through birds to space exploration. And we'll also have a space called an early childhood space called the River of Grass, which will be specifically for early childhood learners, so toddlers through 6-year-olds.
That's great.
It's going to be an amazing place mm-hmm. to go for adults and children.
Yes.
And
yes.
Children. It's fantastic. Just quickly, are there any special exhibits coming up this autumn?
Yes, we will have the Amazon Voyage, Vicious Fishes and Other Riches, which is...
Wait. Vicious Fishes and Other Riches?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it sounds fascinating.
That's the greatest bumper sticker I ever heard of.
It's been a really interesting week. Carlisa Colwood, Director of Programs and Content at the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck on the new museum. It sounds fantastic. Bonnie, great to be with you.
Thank you so much, Linda.
And Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
And great information, Fred.
Yes.
New stuff.
Right. Yeah. Well, next week we're going to be talking with Tim Andriola about his new food concept, Intact Cooking, and his new restaurant. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And we thank you for spending your time with us today. Our producer is Richard Eyes, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. We had assistance today from Mario Lozada, and we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow at this time, join Ed Bell for another live performance from our downtown Miami studios. On South Florida Arts Beat, Ed presents the talented singer-songwriter Sarah Packiam, performing with her band. And then Monday, we return with the first edition of our new series, All in a Day's Work, where we'll go inside some of the more everyday and some not so everyday occupations. Monday, we'll meet Franklin Brown, a Miami-Dade Transit bus driver. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day and weekend are enjoyable. And again, stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.